I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
The thing is about me is I cannot handle weird behavior.
What, people being weird around
yes.
you?
Yes.
Like, what would you constitute as weird behavior?
Like, if someone is, like, praising me incessantly or in, like, a high-energy, effervescent way, I'm like, this is only going to last for about 1 minute. And then me and you can't talk anymore until you realise I'm just a normal human being. And a lot of the times, people don't even know who I am when they're talking to me.
What do you mean?
What?
You've got green hair, green dreads.
Well...
pretty distinctive.
That for sure cuts me off from being Aluna George, which most people know, because Aluna George didn't have green hair.
True.
And you know what it's like when black girls change their hair? They're like, you're someone else, right?
Yeah. I'm going to do an intro. You say you don't like people saying big things about you. Well, I'm going to do it anyway. So.
Go for it. But you've got a whole minute.
1 minute, all right.
I'll time you out.
Okay. We're back again with Utopia Talks. I'm even wearing my Utopia t-shirt today. Lucky you. It's Jaguar here, and today's guest is a big one. Someone who's been the voice and writer of so many of her favourite dance bangers. She's got a distinctive voice and style. Been obsessed with her for a long time. She's squirming. She's a real deal. She's a songwriter, musician, producer, DJ. Also an advocate supporting black electronic artists with her Noir Fever Collective. She's here, looking fab as ever. In the studio, it's Aluna.
Hello. Big roaring round of applause.
Woo!
The walls are clapping. Thank you.
That wasn't so bad.
No, that's...
You're like being polite.
It's your job to introduce me, so it doesn't even... You don't know what I'm talking about when... You're a rational person. Like, because the thing is, I absolutely am okay with it in terms of like... People need somebody to be able to channel certain parts of their energy out of them. And so when that's happening, I understand that's what's happening. And so I'm always really friendly to people, but I'm just saying, like, on a personal level, I wouldn't be able to like hang out with someone who was doing that like a lot and like, or trying not to. That's even worse.
I get you. We're going to be on a level today. But you're in London. You're normally based in LA. I know you're on tour a lot, but you're here in London today because you've got your event on tonight at Somerset House.
I sure do.
Tell us.
Yeah, so this is really like the first Noir Fever event that I would say is like launching the collective. And I like that word collective. I hadn't really given it a term, you know. But yeah, the lineup is incredible. We've got Conductor, Tash LC and Moods and myself. And what I really want to do with this event is show the kind of connection between the kind of black and LGBT roots of dance music and the different genres of dance music from around the world that, for me, are all mainstream dance music. There are lots of pockets of black dance music that sort of live in the underground or sometimes in the mainstream, but I do feel like there's a lot of separation between what is and isn't considered dance music. And for me, I really like to mix it up, and I want lineups that really reflect like my taste in dance music, which is quite broad. And I don't like the way that there isn't enough variety out there for, like, if you're a black person and you want to go to an event that is, you know, if you want to hear techno, house music and garage and GOM and Amapiano, there's not that many places where you can really go and hear that. And I really, really think that that should be made available.
Mm. Yeah, I think that I love that you're doing this collective, and I love that you're being so honest and open, and celebrating and bringing other black dance artists together. And it's someone at your level as well, as you said, is like in a more mainstream space, I think is really amazing to see.
Yeah, because as much as the mainstream gets a bad rep for being commercial, it also is accessible. Mm. And for me, that's the main part. Like when I was growing up, really good dance music wasn't accessible to me, and because I, you know, lived just a little bit too far out from London.
Where did you grow up?
In St Albans.
Okay.
So we had...
Is that Hertfordshire?
Yeah, that's in Hertfordshire. We had this one collective, I'm not really sure what the name was, that played drum and bass, and they would come like once every quarter.
Mm. That was it.
That was it. And then it was like cover bands of Blink 182. It was like a
waste. You in a Blink 182 cover band? That's what I want to know.
Oh no, I did try. I did try and be a rock chick.
Oh yeah.
But you know, there's, you know, we'll get into this later, but there's a lot of genres that like black women are really not accepted in. Mm. I was inspired by Skin from Skunk Anansie, but I wasn't Skin, and I didn't have Skin's band. So it didn't really, I couldn't pull it off. And I was like, okay, there's enough of a challenge getting into music as it is, than trying to do a genre that is so anti-black that I'll try a different way, you know? Even though I really love indie music. It's like one of my favourite genres. So yeah.
Interesting. I mean, yeah, you can tell you've got loads of different like loves of dance music. Because when I first met you, which was earlier this year, that was in Razzmatazz for your Noir Fever in Barcelona, which was so fun, by the way. I was like, what are you going to play? Because you were going to sing and perform and DJ. And you're like, I'm going to start with some reggaeton. And I've actually got such a good video of you on my phone, actually. Just like starting like proper like reggaeton vibe. And then you like built it up and it was amazing. And I love that. And you were talking about like having a night to hear these different sounds and genres. Like it's, yeah, would you say you're inspired by all these different sounds? And where did you come to hear them all, first of all? Because you said you didn't have much in St Albans.
No, but luckily my parents are culturally rich.
Nice.
So like, yeah, that Razzmatazz set, I really wanted to show the connection between reggaeton and dancehall, because obviously they are related, but they live on, you know, in different pockets of the world.
Yeah,
you know. And no, growing up, my dad only like listened to reggae and dancehall. So that was his exclusive genre. He's Jamaican. And my mum was much, much broader in her taste. So she grew up in East Africa. So she would have like African music in the house, but she's Indian. So she'd also have Indian music, and she would have some of the Indian artists who would like break the boundaries, like Nitin Sawhney. I think he was making like, I don't know, like maybe drum and bassy Indian music or something like that. I can't remember. It was like, I remember listening to it and being like, whoa, this is crazy, man. but then at the same time, she would also be listening to Van Morrison and Etta James. And it was quite a wide range of music that she listened to. So if I wanted to dance, that was always African music in the house. Like me and her would whack on a CD, turn the volume up and just dance together. So those are my raves.
So were you a raver when you got a bit older, like teenager? Or
no, they were all gone by the time I was allowed out.
So how did we get from like dancing at home with your mum to African CDs to like becoming one of the biggest dance acts in the UK and globally?
Honestly, you know, there's a lot you can do in your bedroom.
Yeah, yeah.
As long as you can get your hands on the music, But I did get to go to two raves in my life. I went to a drum and bass rave with a friend of mine who lived in London, and he was older than me, and I got to go out with his friends, and it was so funny because I was so much younger than them, and they really saw me like
How old were you?
I mean, I was like 16, but they were all like 19. And you know that age gap is like really like...
At that time, yeah.
And I was like this kid that didn't drink on like my own volition. Like obviously in this country, you can get alcohol whenever you want really. But it didn't really ever agree with me very well. So no drugs. And they were all on like everything and like bragging about it. And I'd be like, that's so interesting that you're still standing. I remember thinking about that. One guy's like, I've had eight. I was like, but aren't you gonna die?
The voice of reason.
I was so innocent. I went to a girl's school. Oh. Like, oh my God. So, but this, I had this one thing about me, which is that I can dance to this music, and I don't have any dancing training. My mum managed to be able to afford dance lessons for about one term. And that was it. And so it was, I remember just being like, I didn't care who was looking at me. I didn't care what anyone else was doing at all. Like zero Fs were given. And I would dance like a crazy woman. And it was just me and this music. And that to me is something that I've always had a very, very direct and private connection with rhythm and dance music. And it's interesting because sometimes I'd be with a friend and they would want me to sort of dance with them to like show them how to dance and kind of bring them in. And I was like, it's really so much down to your own personal relationship with the beat. And I didn't understand why people didn't understand that. And I'm much more gracious about that now, where, you know, I understand as a DJ, like you have to kind of guide people through the beats with your, with being connected to them in that way. But if it was me down on the dance floor, you won't catch me trying to show you how to dance. Like I don't have time for it, because I'm just like, this is my time.
I am one with the music.
Yes,
I am music. Do you ever have those moments when you're on stage and you're like, I'm sick. I am music. I've become music.
The times when I'm able to do that are when I'm in the band, because the band is outside of myself, right? And so I'm able to then again sort of almost like submit to the beat in a way.
Yeah.
It's harder for me to do that with music that I've basically produced.
Yes.
I'm too much part of it. But when another musician is interpreting something I've made and running away with it, then I'm like, I can bow down.
Yeah, no, that is sick. So this year is 2023, which is a 10-year anniversary of Body Music. 2013.
Yeah.
Happy birthday. I was at uni, I think. And like that period felt like a real like golden era of electronic music, and yeah, you guys were at the forefront. And how was that time for you when you, like, how did you kind of make that album? Did you know that album was going to be part of this like kind of new generation of electronic music and be received in the way it was?
Me and George were always waiting for the other shoe to drop, because the way that we made that album was very specifically trying to make something that no one had ever heard before. And with that, we always knew we had that flip side, which is like, well, then people aren't going to know what to do with it. They're not going to know what, like, how to talk about our music or what genre to put us in, and then we'll be like left on the fringes. But the way that we were embraced for that was really, really cool. And obviously it was really amazing to be on that crest of a wave of like SoundCloud and Hype Machine and those kinds of things, which we don't have now. And so we couldn't have known that the general climate of music was so unique at that period of time. But yeah, like we wrote Body Music in George's bedroom, essentially. I mean, not essentially, just that's where we wrote it. And we did it in a very isolated way, because we kind of knew that we had a vision, and that even if we let anyone else get involved, we thought it just wouldn't be us.
Mm.
And so we kept it a really closed kind of creative process. I'm so different now. I collaborate so much more with so many more people now.
Mm.
And I really enjoy that we did that on purpose, because there's so much, like, as soon as you get signed to a label, the first thing they want to do is put you in the studio with other people. And that's what happened to us on our second album. And I don't know what Aluna George fans would say about the difference between those two albums, but I'm sure they would agree with me that having the influence of, like, being put in the studio with Stargate and all these kind of other producers definitely watered down our sound and then kind of created this more commercial thing, which I don't think really suited Aluna George. And I think that was the kind of beginning of the end of that kind of relationship with the label.
Yeah.
Which luckily, like, as much as people have really, really bad experiences with labels, I was able to get us off our deal, like, I think 2 albums early or...
Really?
Yeah.
How did you do that?
Oh.
Did you kick off?
I'm a long gamer.
Nice.
So I had a 2-year strategy.
Oh my God.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Because I was determined. I was like, we're not a major label band. Like, you don't know that until you try it. And although it was really, really successful for us being on a major label, in order for us to continue in a very creative manner, similar to how we had been with Body Music, because we really wrote Body Music before we were signed.
Yeah.
So we needed to get back to that, really, to, like, be able to survive as artists. And so I really strategized and got what I wanted.
Very good. Very good. And you and George, like, what was the reason for kind of parting ways?
Well, there were quite a few reasons. One was that we were now living on other sides of the planet. I moved to LA and George wasn't able to do that. And he hadn't been in the band for a long time already. So he stopped playing in the live show in 2014. So it didn't feel quite the same.
Mm.
And whenever we got together, we'd written so much music by that point that I felt like we weren't challenged anymore. And it was so easy for us to write that I was like, there's something, like, alarm bells go off for me when I get too comfortable. And that's because I know that I naturally tend to hide away from challenge and conflict. So if I'm not scared about something, I know there's a problem.
Yeah.
And so when I asked myself, like, well, okay, what have you not done yet? Like, what are your musical challenges that you haven't faced? And one of the big ones was being a solo artist. And so this might come as a surprise, but when Aluna George was in its, like, fledgling kind of existence, George really wanted me to be a solo artist and he wanted to be my producer. And I was like, that doesn't make any sense, because the way that we write is so split down the middle, 50-50, that it'll feel weird for me to represent you. Like, when some of the songs were, like, about George's dad, or do you know what I mean? I was like, that you have to come and represent your stories. And so, but actually it felt like I was dragging him through being an artist, because, you know, being an artist is not about taking credit. It really, that is, like, almost like an aside. Really what being an artist is getting in the studio with a cameraman and a videographer, doing interviews, doing press, getting on stage, talking to the audience, connecting with the audience. It's always, always this outward expression. And you have to be committed to that. If you're in any way resistant to that, then it's going to just be so hard. And that is what was hard for George. You know, he's such a one-on-one person, and the humbleness is like extreme.
Yeah, some people are just like that, aren't they?
And you can't force them to kind of want to kind of be anything else other than that. And so that was another part of it. I was like, I've dragged this man through being an artist for so long now. I'm gonna let him go. For me, I'm gonna take on the challenge of being the person who makes all the decisions musically. And I knew that the reason that was scary for me is because as a person, I deal with like deep insecurity about who I am, where I come from, where I belong or don't belong. And I never really thought I was enough to sort of carry that full weight of artistry. But working with George for so long, I'd learned much, much more than I realized about production, about what I do and don't like. And I thought to myself, well, I think it's probably just a mindset challenge as opposed to like a skill set challenge.
Yeah. So totally.
Let's just go and see what happens. And like that fear like dissipated so fast as soon as I got into the studio, and it was like, you know, whoever I was working with was like, oh, okay, so what are we doing today? I'd be like, right, so, and I was like, oh, I seem to know what we're doing today. That was kind of like one aspect of what I was scared to do. And I didn't know what my other fears were until I started thinking to myself, like, all right, so now that you're a solo artist, what exactly do you want to do? Because you can do anything. By this point, my songwriting ability and my production, my executive production ability was so broad. I was like, me and George had almost resisted the dance music world for most of our career, because what me and George do really, really well is this kind of glitch wonk take on R&B.
Yeah.
Which I think you could describe body music like that.
Glitch wonk.
Glitch wonk, you know, slight like hip hop beats without the beat or something. You know, the original, you know, you like it. I remember talking to George and we were like, what are you doing here? Because I was like, what's happening? And he was like, well, I tried to make a hip hop beat without a kick drum.
Sick.
I was like, and he was like, so the bass line is the kick drum instead. I was like, oh, see what you did there. So, you know, there was a lot of technical, interesting things we were trying there. But again, I was doing those features alongside Aluna George, which people were obviously associating with Aluna George, but we weren't the ones making dance music at the time together. So I was like, oh, so obvious to me now. I remember I was in the hot tub in LA, and I like jumped out and I was like, it's dance music. I'm going to make dance music.
I could literally like see that. Were you with anyone?
I was, yeah. I've got some pictures of it.
Eureka!
For some reason, there was a photographer there. Amateur photographer. Because I was like, every time I play, people literally just wait until the end of my set when I do the dancier stuff. I was like, they seem to want to listen to dance music from us. People would ask us, like, can you make something a little bit like White Noise and things like that? But I know, that's them. That's what they did. And I was like, why? I wonder why I am scared of making dance music. Like, what would that be about? And I was like, well, I'm a bit of a visitor. You know, I'm a black woman.
You
know, black
Is that people. How you felt? Like a visitor?
Oh, yeah. Like, when I would go up and do, like, sing White Noise or something like that, it was like I was being given like a day pass to a spa. You have to go home after this. You're not a member.
Wow.
Sorry. You're not a member of this club. And I did not think anything twice of it because I was like, well, I'm black and, you know, dance music is white. So why would I? Of course, that's a normal sensation. And I was like, well, for starters, I don't like being boxed out of things. So I'm gonna go and do this genre that's not for me, which is very funny to know that that's how I thought at the time.
And then
but
you
that's genuinely,
at the history.
You know, yeah. You, when you're from the UK, on the whole, I think that's the common conception.
Yes,
especially like I don't know what you call it, the pre George Floyd.
Yeah, the like yeah pre-pandemic, I guess.
Pre-pandemic,
right?
Mindset. And I'd already committed to this and started making dance music before I stumbled across the history of dance music. And I was so mad. I was so mad and surprised and happy all at the same time. But I remember that first thing of like, what? Mm. What? So all this time I've been feeling like an imposter, like a visitor with a day pass, when actually my people created this genre.
Yeah.
And it's been somehow taken away from us. And then we've been tricked into thinking that it's somebody else's. And I was like, how has this happened?
Yeah. But this is the thing. It's like on both sides, like particularly in the UK, but I'd say globally, like there's, if you look at lineups, they're still very, very white and very, very male. And then it's like people in the crowd don't know that it came, the black origins of house and techno, but also like black people in this country, a lot of them still don't know about the origins of house and techno. And it's kind of like constantly having to educate people and remind people and like knock on the door about something that actually did happen but has not been like taken forward as the genre has grown.
Yeah. And I, you know, there are, when you get deep into it, you can really, really debate about the origins of something, right?
Sure.
But you, at the end of the day, you have to take some kind of stance. And my stance is that dance music is not just the use of electronic equipment. It's actually a movement. It's a community. It's an ethos. It's protest. And like, you know, when you go, I think there's a museum. I'm not sure where it is.
Is it the Detroit Museum?
I think it might be the Detroit one. And they do refer to the influence of Kraftwerk, right?
I think it probably is Detroit, I reckon.
Which actually, there's a museum in Germany, a new one, which actually does not acknowledge the black dance roots of dance music.
At all.
Because they say it's not, they weren't trying to make this museum about the actual broad history of dance music. They were just speaking specifically about something. I don't even know. But I'm like, at least from the perspective that dance music was created in Detroit and Chicago, there is an acknowledgement that Kraftwerk was doing some things with some electronic sounds. But they did not create the movement and the
culture,
sound that we associate with house techno. And the thing was, when I first discovered it, I was like, I bet it doesn't sound the same though, does it? It absolutely, it really, I mean, when you listen to original house and tech, you're like, oh, it sounds, yeah, it's like really, you can really, really, like, if you listen to a Kraftwerk track, you're not going like, oh, this is like a really good techno track. You know, you're like, wow, this is very experimental.
Bleeping.
Yes. It's like a happy computer or, so, you know, happy AI going, you know, it's not. So people who were like, that came from Germany. The thing is, it's like, it's so hard for Europeans to acknowledge that something came from America because America's so young. But let's be honest, dance music is an incredibly young genre.
Yes, it is. It
hasn't been around for that long. Most of the pioneers, you know, who are alive today are not that old.
Yeah, like 60s, 50s, 60s.
Yeah.
And It's really interesting, this whole topic, because we had Helena Starr on the podcast a few episodes ago, and she's also an advocate for supporting Black electronic artists and her sets and radio shows. And so we put a clip up on TikTok about her, like, talking about the origins of Detroit techno. And, like, some of the comments were just, like, from white people, stop making everything about race. Another week of bashing white people. It wasn't from Detroit. It's from Germany. This whole debate. And people, why are people so, like, it annoys me because people are so, like, get so defensive and think, like, having a conversation which acknowledges the history of something is, like, an attack, when it's a very important conversation to acknowledge something. Otherwise it gets forgotten, as we've seen, as we've discussed.
Yeah, I mean, I can't pretend that I totally understand the fragility of people who have believed that they created something when they didn't. But I imagine there's such a passionate love of the genre. And if you believe that your people created it and then find out that they didn't, it's kind of, it's like, it's sad for those people, because then you know, you lose your connection with a culture that you're so connected to. But what I say to those people is that when you embrace the Black origins of house and techno, you open yourself up to such a wider world of creativity. Like, some of the Black artists who were experimenting at that time had such imaginative things to show us. Like, I always like to point to Drexia, and their work. I mean, there's a whole sci-fi world that they created around the music that, if you're trying to get re-inspired, because it's a little bit hard to get really fresh inspiration in dance music, let's be honest, because what happened is that there was such a sort of strong, almost like set of rules around dance music, like what the sound is and isn't, that it actually becomes quite hard to break out of that and, like, create something new. And I do feel that with any genre, as much as you might love it, people get bored and they need something new. And if you are a producer at this time, like, I understand people who are fans of the genre, right, who are not creators, getting upset about something being sort of taken away from them. I understand that. But, like, I'm not really sharing the history for them, because I honestly don't think people care
about the history. I guess most people don't. Most people just want to hear music.
Yeah. Which is fine.
Yeah.
But producers and young creatives, that's who I'm talking to when I'm sharing this history. Because I know that it's quite hard to get inspiration. And for me, it was really, really fun for this record that I just put out, Mycelium, I liked to get my imagination into the setting of when house and techno was created. And I was like, okay, so all of our toys have been taken away, all the money has been taken away, the death of disco has obliterated the whole industry, and all I've got left is an 808.
Oh my god,
what do I do?
Love this.
And then go from there, be an inventor.
That is, because
you've got the backdrop of all the music that you've once made, and all the music that's been made, but you don't have any of the resources to do it in that same way. So now what are you going to do?
Expressing your love can look many different ways. And with the right jewelry gift from Blue Nile, it can truly sparkle. Blue Nile's collection of classic diamond jewelry makes for the kind of gift that speaks volumes without saying a single word. Or switch things up with a sapphire piece sure to spark conversation. Either way, Blue Nile's diamond guarantee ensures you get the highest quality at the best price. Express yourself with Blue Nile, the original online jeweler, at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Let's talk about Mycelium, your latest album.
Mm-hmm.
Came out in July.
What?
Was it July? It came out in July?
I really thought you said Comangeli. I was like, Comangeli. Wow. That's a challenge. What is it a type of mushroom?
You tell me, is it a new mushroom tea we're going to try?
Comangeli. Actually, I think it's a film, definitely. Because it's like a spin-off of Jumanji.
About mushrooms.
Yes.
The Mushroom Kingdom.
Yeah.
I mean, Mycelium is like the... It's like the term for the mushroom network, isn't it? What is the actual definition of the word mycelium?
It's like a sort of network of cells.
Okay.
So mycelium just grows underground and connects all of the kind of different roots underground. I don't think it's exclusive to mushrooms, but it's very connected. Mm. But I see the mushroom as the bloom, the fruit.
Okay.
Whereas I see the mycelium cell network, you know, is around us all the time. We don't really see it. You don't, because you don't see mushrooms everywhere that there's mycelium.
Got it. But it's mycelium is like everywhere under the ground connecting everything.
Yes.
An invisible community.
Yes, exactly.
Mm, and the album,
yeah,
if I'm linking this right,
mm-hmm.
feels like you used your network mm-hmm. and community
mm-hmm.
because there's a lot of collaborations on there, actually. And a lot of collaborations with black artists, too. Mm-hmm. Like, you've got Eminem on there, you've got Jada G, you've got Route 94, Tisha,
yeah.
who we had in yesterday.
That MK.
The MK.
Yeah.
Also, the tune of Tisha. I love the album, by the way. And I love all the different, like, sonically and, like, the sort of ending when I'm a piano. And but the Tisha tune, this summer, it's been like on rotation for me. I don't know what it is, but I love that one in particular.
That's her production,
yeah.
Like, I really rate the way that she's so particular about finding that sweet spot of, I've never heard this before, but I can still roll with it.
Mm.
That's really, that's like the Aluna George ethos, like. Well, there's the traditional beat of traditional way to create this beat that we all know. And then how do we dismantle that and just recreate it just a little bit differently, a little bit wonky, but like not too wonky.
Yeah.
And I think that song took so long because she was sort of really hellbent on it being having her sound, because you can hear that kind of pop sensibility in that song.
Mm-hmm.
It's so held back. And that was what she really needed to get going. Because she was like, I don't want it to be too just like a pop song. That's like, I feel you.
Yeah, that's so cool. And what about some of the other collaborations on there? Like what were some of your favorite tunes to make when you made them?
I mean, definitely working with MK.
Mm.
That was huge for me because having discovered the roots of house and techno, I was like, this man has been there for the entire time.
Yeah, because how old is MK?
I'm not sure.
I don't know.
Because like when you meet him, you're not getting any closer to the actual number, honestly.
But he's been like ever present for forever.
Yeah, but in person, he gives like tall teenager energy.
Interesting.
But I couldn't See, this is the, you know, what we were talking about before? I don't even know if you put it in the podcast, Ian, because we were talking about it before we started. But I was so shy around him. I could not get my mouth to open at all. I was just all blubbery because I was just, you know, I'd done all this research and I was just like, oh my God, you're such a legend. And so...
How was he in person?
He's also quite quiet.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But sort of regal. And so that combination is that kills me. I'm like, no, we're not going to speak now. I'm just going to sit and stare at you, but you won't see me staring at you because I actually have really strong peripheral vision.
And he's really quiet. So he's also just sat there like...
He's just fine being himself, you know, just like... But yeah. But when he kind of like played me the version that we hear now, like where my, the sweetness of my voice was like a contrast with the backdrop of that dirty, dark beat, I was like, that really threw me. I was like, because normally I have something to say. You know, we could change like all these things. And I had nothing to say. I was just like, jaw drop. Thank you.
Goodbye.
And well.
So that's Kiss It Better, the MK tune. How about the Jada G track?
Oh, that was so much fun.
Loved seeing you two on a tune together.
We bonded on, you know, that unique experience of being a black woman in dance music, which, you know, there's not many of us. There's more of us now, which is really, really cool. But... When I embarked on this project, I could not see any contemporaries. And so I'm really, really proud of every single collaboration on this album because I feel like I have spent... It's like finding a lover, right? You feel like you've spent your whole life trying to find this person. And it really felt like that with every one of these collaborations because, you know... What I feel is that like there are black people in dance music, but we're so separated by like a sea of white people that it's actually quite hard to connect because what will happen is like you'll be the only black person on a lineup or you'll be the only black person on that label. And there's, you know, to get the number of people you have to wade through to get to that person. And there's also not a culture of connecting us. A lot of us artists who have teams are really kind of being guided by those teams because we're busy just making product, right?
Yeah.
And so those teams are suggesting like, you work with this person, you work with this person, how about this, you know? And so if no one is suggesting that you work with this one other black person that's on the other side of the planet, it's not going to happen unless you really, really have a very specific vision and that you spend your time like finding these people. And so that's what I did. And otherwise, I would never have got this kind of caliber of artists on my album. And that research really started like way, way back. Like that's like 3 years of research and connecting and building to get the album that I have now.
And how was that whole process? Like how was it working with fellow black artists in electronic music?
It was,
because did you explain to them like the reason, like the whole thought process behind the album?
I did. And the main thing I would share is that that scenario that I talked about of like, all right, we're going to go back to the origins and that and the birth of house and techno, okay, in our minds. And it, I could just every time I described that feeling or that scenario to people, I could just see light bulbs just going off. And I just knew that no one else has ever suggested that in the studio. And it was that togetherness of discovery. Almost like as if I was like, let's look at our family tree and see connections that we never knew were there. So it just felt so new. It just, and I was like, that's just a gift to both of us. And I started to learn that not necessarily through music collaborations, but actually through deciding that I wanted to connect Black ravers. A lot of my motivation is the moments when I've been on stage and I'm the only Black person on my side of the fence. So there's no one Black backstage.
Yeah.
There's no one Black on the lineup. There's no one Black working tech. There's no Black managers. There's no Black agents. It's just me.
It feels very isolating.
Very. And then I would get on stage and then everyone would be white except for like one Black girl at the front.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, obviously if there was a Black girl in the back, I can't see them. So it would there may have been like one or two others, right?
Sure.
But pushing your way to the front as a Black girl is work. Because no one's parting the sea for you, okay? You've got to be extra polite and not threaten anyone with your either skin or size or hair or anything like that to get all the way there. And I'd see that person, I'd be like, yeah, it's just me and you, babe. And I kind of accepted that as our lot in life. And then I was like, during the pandemic, when we were going through this revolution, really, in how we think about race post the death of George Floyd, I realized that those Black ravers who previously had been hanging by a thread, which is that thread would be like, I love house and techno or whatever genre, EDM genre. So none of my friends are going to come with me. So I'm probably just going to go alone to this festival because I love this music so much. And the white people at that festival are just going to be like, okay with me being there. But when it came to that moment and you turn around as a Black person in those environments and there is no Black Lives Matter support, vocal, because like the EDM scene was very quiet around that time. Very, very quiet. I knew that all of those people were just about to just leave the scene or at least not feel as comfortable as they once did, which was to say that it was more like, I'm not comfortable, but I'm willing to just go through this experience just so I can dance to house and techno. Whatever genre of EDM you like.
So are you referring to more of the US scene, I guess?
I would say that in the UK, Black people were kept in our genres, right? We have dance music genres that are considered ours, right? Grime.
Yeah.
But on the whole, every other dance music genre is considered white.
Yeah.
And so there was like legislation here that was strategic in breaking up.
That was the form, what was it called? Form 972, for the venues.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it's called.
So like Black people getting together and listening to music in a kind of mainstream public way was not
accepted or possible.
Yeah.
Mm.
So I'm not going to say that it's just exclusively America.
Well, the reason I ask is because since, again, like kind of post-pandemic, in the UK, there's an artist and a DJ called Nyx who's created something to help alleviate this problem and to help champion artists, and she's made something called the Black Artist Database. Have you heard of it? Maybe not. It's very like UK centric currently. I'll definitely send it over to you. You should definitely connect with Nyx. And it started off as a spreadsheet with just loads of artists making electronic music and links to their SoundCloud and Bandcamp. And now it's actually a whole website where you can, you know, and they have a podcast, they do events, they have links to directly that goes to Bandcamp so you can buy music and support Black artists, and it's got thousands of artists on there adding to it daily. You should definitely
definitely
check it out and connect on that. But And it does feel like, again, I'm talking kind of UK centric because that's been my experience, like kind of post pandemic, there have been amazing things that have come out of these realizations and changes, and there is a bit more ownership of Black artists and acceptance in the wider scene that there is a need for this. But equally, I'm very aware it's not perfect and there's a lot of a way to go. But it's sick that even exists.
Yeah, that's amazing. But that started, what, 3 years
yeah,
ago?
Yeah, 3 years ago.
So a lot of what I'm talking about is like pre.
Yeah.
3 years ago.
Yeah. The thing you mentioned about reaching out to Black ravers, because I saw you did an Instagram post as well, like maybe earlier this year, being like, if you're Black and you like dance music, comment below, and to kind of build a bit of a community.
Yeah. And I what I was going to say is that I learned through actually creating space for those people to connect how valuable that moment is. So I would get people to join me on a Zoom, and their first thing was to go around and talk about what it's like to be Black at a festival. And people would get so emotional, having never ever had the space or opportunity to share like how uncomfortable it is, and in a safe space with other people. And I was like, this is interesting. Like, these people have, I can feel their energy has like become so much more elevated. And then they would start to talk about what changes they want to see, and they would, you know, get much more empowered. And I was like, well, what would happen to like artists if they were allowed to do the same thing, if they were allowed to congregate and be on the same lineup and connect and be able to talk and share their experiences? Like, maybe you'd have a completely different performance from them at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And different music would come out. Because I haven't really seen, like, you know, there's a lot of collaborations that go on, you know, basically in the credits.
Yeah.
And that's the space that I really wanted to penetrate with my album, where it's like the credits are full of Black people as well. Not, you know, not just the one sort of face of it.
Yeah.
Because it's a, you know, very collaborative space. But a lot of the time you'll just be collaborating with white people because they're so abundant and highly talented. I must say, when you've had control over the genre for 40 years, what comes with that is investment and development of talent.
Yeah, of course. But also, you know, you've proven through your album that there's just loads of talented Black artists as well. And I think maybe people just stick with what they know in terms of like labels and mainstream. Oh, let's put these two in a session. Let's put them in a session. But actually,
it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
So I understand how it happens.
But you've proven that it's possible to make amazing music just by and thinking slightly differently about who you want to get involved.
Yeah. I mean, what comes with that is saying no multiple times a week. You know, like, this white producer would like to work with you. He's got numbers. He's got an audience. He's got everything that you don't. And I have to say no to that so that I have the time and the energy to work with people I want to. And, you know, people see me as a successful artist, but I don't own my own house, by the way. Like, I've made huge sacrifices to stay within a space that I feel comfortable with. And that's the interesting thing that people don't think about is, like, you know, within the Black community, when we talk about working with other Black people, you know, there's a lot of anger around when people don't and resentment. And I've been on both sides of the fence. It's like, where's the money?
Yeah.
At the end of the day, where's the money? And are you in a position where you need to feed yourself, or are you in a position where you're fed? And I was in such a privileged position, and that's what I used, but I wasn't ever in that position before. But at that point in my career, when I went solo, I was like, I'm fed, okay? We don't have a house, okay, but like, we're gonna make some changes to the way we work, even though, you know, we're not saying yes to every high profile DJ that I could collaborate with to get my bread and butter.
Yeah. So where, and also like, that's incredible to hear, by the way, like, and this is why I wanted you on, like, I rate that you've done that and you've acknowledged, yeah, maybe I'd get more money or be easier to do this way, but you're doing it your way. And I think seeing that and the kind of music that you are creating that is like penetrating a mainstream space is incredible. And I hope it, you know, inspires other people to do the same. And like, moving forward, what would you want to see the industry looking like off the back of what you've been doing this year?
I think what I really like is, by being an example, what I'm trying to do is kind of almost subliminally change the mindset. So what I was dealing with and what I still deal with is the mindset is like, black women are there to be songwriters, singers, and featured artists. And I want that assumption to switch to that most probably this black woman is an artist in her own right. So when I approach her to work with me, my first go-to suggestion would be, would they like to collaborate?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe if they'd prefer not to be in a collaboration, they'd rather be paid as a featured artist and then I take ownership over that song, then that's up to them. They can suggest that. Or if they'd not even like to be named, they actually don't want to be an artist.
Yeah.
On this record, and they'd rather just sing it and that be, you know, your track. But that's not how I'm coming in out of the gate.
Yeah.
And that, it's like, changing mindsets is a much more nuanced game. Because it's not, you can't just kind of like, right, be like, this is the new rule. Because you're changing psychology.
Yeah.
So what I felt is that the only way to do that is to actually represent to the world. Like, I no longer do features.
Yeah, this is what I was going to say, because you are an artist and you do all these different aspects of being an artist. But some people who might not appreciate or understand what goes into that, they might still view you as, and I don't want to just say just, but just a vocalist, because you have featured. So how do you navigate that? And do you feel that sometimes you get pigeonholed as something, like reduced to something you're not? Because I would get kind of pissed off, because you are so involved in your creative process. You are the driving force. You are involved in every aspect.
Well, I don't get pissed off, because I know that when I went into when I did the features that I did, I knew what I was doing, and in that, like, that I was essentially giving over or selling my creativity to someone else so that they could use it as part of their business.
Yeah.
But what I didn't know is that I could do anything else other than that. I made the choice, but there wasn't a choice, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the, you know, knowledge is the game. Knowledge is the game. And if you didn't have the knowledge, then you made the best decision you could make, but it was still my decision. And now I can make other decisions, and I can show other people that there are other decisions that can be made. But, you know, everyone was working with the mindset that we all had. My mindset was also that, you know, this other producer is far more important than me. There's always a game of leverage in this industry. And I'm somebody who, I struggle with being a very obedient person, a subservient person. Mm. And that, you know, to a certain point, that is my kind of the effects of racism on me that I try to undo slowly. But it's not that anyone forced me to be a featured artist.
Yeah. I just, because this is something we've spoken about on the podcast before, and like previously I think season one, we had Becky Hill, Angie Brown and Roetta on, talking about these topics as, you know, as people who songwrite and do vocals. and kind of the disparity and sometimes like lack of recognition, lack of credit for sometimes, you know, you write the song and you might do production of the song, but then a lot of the time, again, if we're looking at like mainstream dance music, the primary artist can be the often male producer, and then sometimes the vocalist is a feature or maybe not featured at all. Angie Brown spoke about how she was at the time still trying to get the royalties for She Sang On, I'm Gonna Get You Baby, I'm Gonna Get You, Yes I Am. She was still trying, that was came out in the 90s, still trying to get royalties, and that was 2 years ago. Martha Wash, I think she sings Everybody Dance Now, wasn't in the music video or isn't credited as the vocalist of that tune. And obviously this strings back to like 80s, 90s. Often it's black women who are like pushed out, not recognized. So have you, you must have had to fight to get to the point you as a solo artist to have all of these credits to your name. Like, I think that's really inspiring.
There's a whole world around that that happens, right? Because in order to capitalize on being credited as a main artist, you have to be a main artist. There's no point in getting the full credit for something, but then you're not also putting out your own music as a main artist. Mm. And that's to do with investment. And so, you know, when I was looking at these disparities and challenges, I was like, okay, that's the kind of symptom, really. But like, so in a business sort of arrangement, you know, if you are someone who has previously done a lot of session work and you're not actually an artist, and then you come to this collaboration, they're going to assume that there isn't any way for you to capitalize on being a main artist. So that you may as well just be another, be another singer on this, this track, because the other person, guess what, who can capitalize that on that is the producer who's been invested in by his label. He's been backed by radio. He's been backed by being booked on lineups, on DSP platforms, et cetera, et cetera. And so what is the question here? It's not just in that business transaction, should she be a main artist? It's about should the label that she's on be investing in her as an artist instead of pimping her out as a songwriter? Should the people around her be communicating in emails, like, you know, before she even gets to the session, that this is going to be a collaboration? It was all of these kind of steps and levels. It's not, there was no like band-aid fix to it. Cause of course you can be like, you can get into a room and start trying to upgrade your leverage in real time. Like, actually I'm an artist now. It's not going to work that way. Yeah, Somebody has to invest in you. And so that's the last moment that has to happen. What has to happen before that is people have to see raw talent in a young black woman who has a voice and songwriting skills and performance skills and go, oh, guess what? This person could actually be a really good artist.
Yeah.
I'm going to invest in this person. And when I talk about her working with other people, this producer could write a beat for her. Not she could lend her talents to this other person just because she's up and coming.
Yeah.
It's a complete change of mindset in the whole ecosystem. This is the thing. And so for that reason, you know, the Noir Fever Collective on the event side is only one part of my plans. The other part is also to be investing in up and coming black artists, because I know how much that has to do with what direction they end up going in. There is the question of, are you suited to be an artist?
Sure.
That same question goes for producers as well. And you've got a lot of producers who are not suited to be artists, who kind of are sort of invested in and pushed forward just because they're a talented white guy.
Yeah.
And so I would say to those people who are making those investments, broaden your horizons, because sometimes those producers are not right to be artists. They should be in the background, because we should have background people in all levels of the industry, but we should also have those foreground people.
Mm.
And what you're doing sometimes is investing in the wrong people. You need to broaden out and be like, I'm going to take a bet on this black girl that she could actually be. Like, and it goes for production as well, you know. Mm. Black female producers, non-binary producers can often be relegated to not even the background, I have to say. Like, it's really interesting. There's like not much faith in black female and non-binary producers.
So why do you think that is?
I think that it's a hard question to answer, because when I find someone who just is talented, I don't know how they arrived there.
Mm. Mm.
To me, it looks like they just had so much conviction against all the odds. Because sometimes I'll meet like young white producers and I'm like, you just floated into this. But the reason that you floated into this is because you've kind of been invested in,
yeah,
without you realizing it, by society.
And it's like, it's
by seeing other white male producers,
exactly,
making it.
You can't be what you can't see. So they think, oh, okay, he looks like a producer, so that he must do it. Well, let's make him a producer.
Right. Because honestly, if like, I've studied production, right? I consider myself an executive producer, mm, because I don't really enjoy the process of engineering. You know, I understand how to make sounds out of sine waves,
mm,
and manipulate them into a new growly bass line that no, yep, one's ever heard before. But that takes forever and it's like very nerdy. But it's not hard.
Mm.
You know, trading isn't hard. You just learn graphs and stats and, you know, you just, it's not hard. It's just, it's like you said, you can't necessarily be what you can't see.
Mm.
I think that's really, yeah, what it is. It's like the number of times that you've ever seen a black female or non-binary sort of, I call them artist producer or super producer on stage playing their own beats, mm-hmm, with someone else singing is very rare.
But I feel like we are getting to a point where we are seeing more of this, and yeah, it's just, it like, as a positive, and like, you know, as a mixed race girl in the industry in electronic music, like, it, I do feel hopeful. And like, you know, yourself and some of the collaborations we've talked about, so many amazing black artists doing this who are making music. And you mentioned earlier before we start recording, like Anne's and Jada G and Tisha and Nia Archives, and it is really exciting.
So like, I struggle a little bit with, when you're making change, there is so much you can focus on that's negative to complain about.
Mm.
And so how do you get from there to taking action? And one of the things that really is my motivator is, it's a very business kind of philosophy.
Okay.
It's like, if you're going to sell a product, you need to find a gap in the market. And it's really hard to find a gap in the market. It's really hard to solve an issue that people don't know needs to be solved. But in this case, it is a, like, the gap in the market for black women and non-binary artists, mm, to be in dance music is so huge and glaringly obvious.
Totally.
That I'm like, everyone, this is the gap. Like, if you think you can fill this gap, get in there. I don't care what skill level you're at. You can, in 1 year, I can guarantee you, in 1 year with one course, whether you're paying someone to sit next to you and baby step you through the whole thing, or you're doing an online course, whether you will be able to make a banging track within a year.
Mm.
Get going, because the world of dance music is bored. Let me tell you that. When I go out So a lot of these places where what most people are hearing is the same old stuff, like, they need fresh takes on this genre. And Black women and non-binary artists are going to be the best at that.
Totally.
Because we're going to have the freshest take. We're coming from basically being outside of the genre for so long. And even, you know, when you look at it on another perspective, we have been the soul and heart and soul of this genre.
Yeah.
For all of this time. But let's be not just the heart and soul, let's be the technical side too, because there's something interesting about, like, when I put my mind to the intricacies of a beat, I really do come up with something different to other people just because of who I am.
Yeah, exactly. You're bringing different experience, different point of view, different just life experience. And I feel like that is how you develop society in a different way as well. Like, I always wheel this quote out, so I apologize if you've heard this before, anyone, but there's a writer who was called Audre Lorde, who was a Black feminist writer in like the 80s, and she wrote that the world is evolving through women, and that in that, like, in the context of kind of any minority, really, like, throughout the way society is built, it's built by, like, the patriarchy and, like, in general, white men. And then it's like, you know, women were, like, killed and died in childbirth. But now it's like getting to a point where women, non-binary people, queer people, people of color are actually having opportunities to contribute and help build society. And instead of just, like, going in this direction, we can go in this direction and do things in a different way, because now there's actually an opportunity for other people who aren't the canon to create. And I think that's a really great way of looking at evolution.
Absolutely. And I think as music lovers in the Black community, we need to embrace the concept of reclaiming a space for us to dance.
Mm.
You know, for too long, I think we've kept away from rave spaces, you know. I understand it because, honestly, it's not been safe for Black people to be in public raving because we've been so heavily policed.
Yeah.
And I think that people who go to events don't realise they have a voice. And I'm here to say that you do. If you are a Black woman who wants to go to an electronic dance music rave and not have your hair touched, not have your body touched, not have people slap your ass because you're dancing the way that you dance, then you can demand that.
Yeah. Or come to a Noir Fever night.
Come to a Noir. Well, you know, we haven't even done our first one yet, but soon to come.
Yeah. I'm excited for tonight. I think we're going to wrap up.
Yeah.
So I am going to ask you your utopia. Take us to Aluna's utopia.
It's really being on stage and looking out to see faces from all around the world, all different colors, all different genders, and all different sexual orientations being together, but completely submitting to the beat is my utopia.
Submitting to the beat. Mm-hmm. Have you said that before, or did you just, like, come up with that in this podcast?
I do think that we may have come up with that in this podcast because...
You said it a few times. I'm like, that should be a thing.
Yeah, submit to the beat.
We're going to hear that in your next single, I swear.
I think it's definitely different from dancing.
People
get confused. They're like, I don't know how to dance. I'm like, yeah, but do you know how to submit to the beat? The beat will tell you what to do.
Yeah, just let the beat take you away.
Yeah.
Luna, thank you so much for coming on. This has been a pleasure.
It's been really, really, really fun to talk to you, like, in this kind of setting where we get deep about things. Because obviously we can throw down on a good night together, but yeah. This is different.
Yeah. And tonight, see you there. Can't wait.
Yes.
Woo.
Utopia Talks is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The championship season is over, and what a season it was.
But the best is yet to come. It's the playoffs.
Who will make it to the Premier League?
And who will be left heartbroken at Wembley?
Stay across it all with The Second Tier.
We're bringing you episodes after every leg.
And in between, we're revisiting the greatest moments in playoff history.
It's real conversation with two real championship obsessives.
So you can be in the know about everything happening in the playoffs.
And share all your new knowledge in the pub with your mates.
So come join us.
We're your one-stop shop for the playoffs.
Search Second Tier in your podcast app
and hit subscribe.